Costs to originate keep rising, even with more technology in the industry. The problem is the core platform. A new LOS can re-architect the process around data, not humans moving paper files. Vesta has built this LOS, and you can learn more at vesta.com.
Everybody, my name is James Kleiman. I'm the managing editor at HousingWire. We've got a great episode for you today. We're going to be talking about the mortgage rate lockdown. We're going to be talking about where rates are heading, how mortgage lenders are changing up their strategies in the face of a pretty difficult environment. And we're going to also talk about some major news, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac on the real estate commission cases. Today's episode is sponsored by Vesta. Everybody, this is James Kleiman. I am the managing editor at HousingWire. And today from our newsroom is Neil Pearson. He is also an editor at HousingWire. And we're going to talk all things mortgage today. There's a lot of stuff going on. I think the big one is really, from my perspective, I remember around Christmas time and the spreads were really narrowing. And there was so much optimism about what 2024 might bring. I feel like rates were in the low sixes at that time. And so many companies were talking about, how do we hire again? Do we need more processors? Do we need more underwriters? Is this going to be a huge momentum builder from what was a pretty crappy year, right? 2023. And here we are now. And I'm looking at the HousingWire Rate Center, and rates are in the mid sevens, right? So didn't quite work out. Neil, we just published a story from Flavia Furlan Nunez, and it's really about kind of the mislaid expectations and where things are. So how are mortgage lenders adapting to the recovery that never was?
Yeah, great question, James. And thanks for having me on the podcast today. I think a lot of people still have a lot of unanswered questions at this point. We're still, obviously, in the last 3 to 6 months, people's expectations have sort of been blown to bits in terms of what the mortgage rates were, where they were hopefully going to go. And, we just haven't gotten to where people really want to be at this point. And there's a variety of things that obviously go into that. The jobs reports continue to outpace expectations. Companies are still hiring by and large in this country. The Fed has obviously, one could argue the Fed got started too late on its rate setting policy. And, we could spend a whole hour on something like that. But, obviously the Fed has made its moves to increase rates. And but inflation has obviously ticked up again here in the last couple months. And so there's some worrisome signs for everybody that that things are going to revert back to where we were, 2 years ago. And so there's a lot of unanswered questions. I think the smart lenders obviously have baked some of these rate increases into their current pricing. But the way that I've the talk that I've seen around the industry is, these first 6 months of 2024 were going to really set a tone for how well companies were able to not just thrive, but just survive. And I don't think we're seeing a ton of momentum turning at this point. And so, the ones that have prepared well are in a better position, but it's not a good time to have been in the industry if you're if you're expecting your rates to be down in the low sixes at this point, you're fighting an uphill battle.
Yeah, I've been chatting with a lot of lenders in the last month or two because I hear so much chatter about all these smaller and mid-sized lenders that don't have a lot of servicing revenue that they can sell anymore. They don't have the MSRs, they don't have the cash. They're getting pretty close on their reps and warrants and not a lot of options, right? So you either need to figure something out pretty soon or you leave it up to chance. And there's not a lot of flexibility if you lose a warehouse line and suddenly you can't fund your commitments. Maybe you become a broker shop, right? Maybe you do something else. And then hopefully there's a like-minded competitor out there who's willing to absorb you and your staff and you're comfortable getting a little bit of a payout. But it's a tough marketplace. And what I hear is it's more likely that we're going to see 8% than it is that we're going to see high fives, low sixes. And if you think back to where we were even a couple months ago, I don't think that was the expectation for most people in the industry. And so, you know, if you're operating your business as if we're going to see rates in the sixes, I think you're probably in a really tough spot. But I also know of lenders that have made money in the last month or two, because you can manage a situation if there are predictable spreads, if there's less volatility, even if the rates are high. People know that they're not getting back to 2%, 3% rates. And if they're willing to buy, great, they'll buy. Sure, there are going to be fewer move-up buyers out there, but there are always, you know, the situations where there's a divorce, unfortunately, or a death, or you have another kid, right? Or you know, the life events are still going to happen. There's still going to be first-time home buyers who are in the market, because renting is not exactly a great proposition right now either. Rents are going back up, right? So it can still be a solid market if you didn't get too big and grow too fast, and if you have some liquidity and you still have options. If you don't have options, you don't have a lot of liquidity, I think this is going to be a pretty bad year.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, to point out what Flavia said in her story, which you know, we obviously should promote that. You know, her story just went live today. It's entitled "As a Higher for a Longer Rate Scenario Unfolds, How Is the Mortgage Industry Adapting?" And she talks in here about how that you know, the analysts that she spoke to were expecting more mergers and acquisitions this year than originally planned. And there's really not a lot of bandwidth at this point for lenders to be conducting a lot more layoffs. I think probably a lot of people at this point are already bare bones. And, you know, as we discussed, you know, going into the year, people were expecting to be in a different position where they could do some more hiring, you know, whether it's processors, underwriters, people on the closing desk. And that's just not materializing at this point. So what do you do at this point to try and retain those people that are keeping your bottom line where it is?
I think the challenge there is a lot of the lenders have absolutely gotten the bare bones with their processors and underwriters and, you know, all of the critical staff that you need to actually originate a loan. But you have all these other big costs, right? All these compliance costs. They're hard to wrestle with. And you also have a lot of lenders that still have a ton of loan officers that are not producing, certainly not producing to the levels that I think one would hope for. And in a lot of cases, this is 30% of your, you know, of your staff, right? 30 to 50% of your staff isn't reaching the target that you need. And although certainly there are already probably about 100,000 loan officers that have washed out from the peak of the mortgage cycle, say 2021, I think there's still tens of thousands more that are going to be looking at, you know, not having originated more than six units in a year. And that's not sustainable, right? I mean, that doesn't work for either the lender, and it doesn't work for the loan originator. And so there are more cuts to be done. And I think it's probably going to be more on the sell side. There are a lot of companies out there that also are able to use pretty smart analytics and determine, hey, is this underwriter touching enough files? And if they're not, they're going to be on a PIP, right? You either train them up and they're able to hit whatever that minimum standard you set is, or there isn't going to be a job. And so it's going to come down to, I think, a market of skill sets. And it's already somewhat that, but I don't think we've fully hit, you know, the peak performance versus the efficiency of where, you know, the lender could be. There are still a lot of costs that haven't really been accounted for. But I do think for the vast majority of lenders, I mean, they have cut to the bone. It's just, which piece of the bone do you want?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I think we've seen this on the real estate side of the business too, where, you know, the model has changed where the people who were, you know, selling maybe one, two houses a year, they're probably not going to be making it. And in a changed environment where commissions are not what they used to be, you know, obviously a lot of unanswered questions left on that side of the business. But I think there's a lot of similarities there between the real estate and mortgage sides that, you know, anybody who's really plugged in are using, you know, advanced KPIs to measure employee performance. And it's, you know, fairly easy to tell, you know, when somebody is sort of pulling their own weight. And we can talk about that phrase about how 80% of the work is done by 20% of the employees. That's sort of true across all industries. And I think there's probably some evidence out there that that's true in mortgage and real estate, too. And so if you're not part of that top 20% who's sort of pulling their weight and really driving profitability for your company, what's going to be your role? There may not be a role.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And we've talked about this before on the real estate side, and there are a lot of companies out there, a lot of brokerages that have the model where it's just like you want to have as many agents as possible, and you want to, it's a badge of honor to have 70, 80,000 agents. And I think, you know, when you really look at the costs and the models associated, that's probably not going to work if they're not also producing agents. And on the mortgage side, I think it's a little bit different because a lot of them are also salaried and, you know, the comp structure is quite a bit different. But definitely it is a market of skills, and it's going to be even more a market of skills as we get further away from this idea that the 6% mortgage is going to come back and that inventory is going to shoot up. I mean, if you look at even just the mortgage rate lock-in effect, as it's called, we see there are just a lot of people who I think in other markets would have sold, and they're not going to. And there was a really interesting study from the FHFA that came out, I want to say about a week or two ago, and they look at this idea of the so-called lock-in effect, and they're trying to quantify how many millions of sellers just never sold their home because they've got a 2.4% mortgage or whatever it is, and they're looking at a 7.4 mortgage. And if you look at the dollars and cents involved, if you quantify the mortgage rate that they're locked into as an asset, it's at minimum a $50,000 asset. That would be the difference in price. And, you know, from a monthly payment standpoint, it's $500 a month or more that you would have to make up for. And so a lot of people are just saying, you know what, I'm perfectly happy with where I am. Maybe, you know, my home office is a little cramped. Maybe that nursery is going to become a nursery and the baby is going to be next to our bed and, you know, crying and getting up at all night. But the cost of me trying to find a new home, another town over, or relocate somewhere else and have to pay, you know, $600, $700, $800 more a month, maybe even more, it's just not worth it. So I'm not going to take that job.
Absolutely. You know, I'll give a personal example. I've owned my home here in the Seattle area for 9 years now. We bought at a what would now be considered a very, very cheap price point. You know, you probably couldn't find a shack for the price that we bought at the time. And so 9 years later, 8 years later, we refinanced our original mortgage. That was in September 2021. We've refinanced at 2.875%. And, you know, there is absolutely no incentive from my standpoint as a consumer to try to get rid of that mortgage to look for, you know, a larger house. I'm in a fortunate spot where I don't have to do that sort of thing. You know, I have teenage sons who, you know, we're not expanding our family, have enough room for me and my one son who live with me. And so, you know, there's not a reason to try to trade in that in that low rate mortgage for something more costly. But you're right. You know, going back to what you said about, you know, life events, people get married, people have kids, you know, new jobs come up, necessitate moves to different parts of the country. All that's sort of going to factor into to the business that that originators can expect to get. But, it, you know, the lock-in effect has proven to be very real. I'm glad you brought up that study from the FHFA and that, you know, there's smart people out there that are really trying to decipher this, because it's a real thing. How quantifiable it is sometimes up for debate, but, you know, from my perspective personally, I can see exactly why this is happening and why there are a lot of disincentives to move.
Yeah, and then there are also second order effects and third order effects. You know, it does have a lot of different kind of related issues. And so there was a story that came out on, I want to say Bloomberg, on Thursday or Friday, and it was just about this idea that all of these companies had moved down to the New South, as they call it, right? And they're getting big tax incentives and, you know, all these like pilots, as they call them, payment in lieu of taxes, and they're trying to hire people and bring them down to wherever, South Carolina or Georgia or whatever. And they can't get people to move down there because they're locked in a rate at 2.6, 2.8%, right? And they're saying, yeah, okay, you're going to pay me $100,000, which is, you know, let's say a $15,000 or $18,000 pay bump, but my annual costs to try to buy a home down there would be double that, right? Because there's one, it's not like house prices have dropped in these areas either. I mean, we're seeing some of the biggest, you know, upticks in home prices from some of these areas in the New South. You know, like my parents bought a home in kind of the exurbs, let's call them, of Raleigh, North Carolina in, what was it, like August of 2021. They spent $420,000+. And that house had been on the market, I think it was 2 years prior, for like $260,000, right? And it's not like, you know, my parents have lost any value on this home they bought. And it's not my taste, it's kind of McMansion-y, but you know, they bought this in 2021. They've probably already gained another $50,000-$60,000 in value for a house they bought, you know, barely 2 years ago, right? So now they get to work from home. They're semi-retired, so it doesn't affect them. But if you can't attract workers from New York or Michigan or, you know, wherever it is that you want to get workers, I think that could start to slow down the economic growth in some of these areas where we've seen big, big, big spikes, both in home prices and just in how many people have moved down there, right? So I think it's a pretty interesting dynamic to look at. And, you know, the mortgage rate lockdown is going to affect different communities unequally.
Absolutely. Actually, that brings to mind, you know, Brickley Hahn, our real estate reporter, put together a market report on Austin, Texas recently. And thinking back on you know, editing that piece and reading what she had to say about it, you know, Austin was at the start of the pandemic, it was hotter than any place in the country. You know, if you look back there 4 years ago, everybody and their dog wanted to move there. And it didn't really matter where you were in the country at the time. Austin was the hot property. But 4 years later, things look much different. And, you know, there's been such an influx of people that have moved to that area that to reasonably call it an affordable market is really no longer plausible. And so, you know, they've reached a point where cheap housing just really doesn't exist, certainly not on a large scale level. And so the agents that are working, you know, down there have really struggled to unlock inventory like most other parts of the country. They're not thinking back to the data that she produced, you know, 300 to 400,000, you know, is sort of a starter home price point in that area. And you know, the people that she talked to, they're just there's not any sort of meaningful supply opening up at those price points.
Yeah, I mean, there are always nuances to every market. I mean, Austin is one of the interesting cases because it's one of, you know, three or four markets in the country in which there is, you know, as much inventory as there was in 2019. And now Austin is interesting because they've also had a huge number of multifamily apartment buildings. Their zoning is a little bit more developer friendly than a lot of areas. And where we have seen just big infrastructure allowances for housing, we have seen prices starting to decelerate. And so it's, you know, kind of the Tampa area, the Austin area, San Antonio, and then Minneapolis. These are, you know, a handful of markets in the entire country where we've stopped seeing the big gains. Now, that might be sad for someone who bought in 2022 or 2021 when, you know, the market was absolutely insane, and now it's tempered a little bit. But that's because there is a little bit more inventory than I think, you know, we're talking like the whole of inventory, right? People can now move to an apartment if they want in that area. And you know, if you are somewhere else, it's, you don't have many options, right? And so the landlord, the home seller have a big advantage over the buyer. And the other thing about Austin is like, they've built so much of what they call luxury housing, right? And it's like $5,000 apartment rentals. And people look around and they say, you know, that's a little rich for my blood. And that apartment unit will linger. It'll sit on the market for months and months and months. And the developer will have to take, you know, $3,400, right? Instead of $5,000. Now, $3,400 is still probably more than what anybody would have paid in 2019. But it's not what I think people expected, you know, even 2 years ago. So, yeah, I mean, every market is so interesting and so unique. And Seattle's a pretty crazy market these days still, more defined by basically no inventory than most markets in the country. And I think we're going to continue to largely see those trends until we actually build some housing in this country.
Absolutely. You know, and we've Housing Wire has been obviously covering, you know, a lot of the housing proposals that the Biden administration has laid out recently. And, you know, it really doesn't matter what your viewpoint is on that, whether you agree on them or not. Like, I think that everybody can sort of see that there is this missing part of the plan that has to do with supply. And so if we're not addressing that, if we're not coming up with new zoning regulations, to encourage developers to build sort of that low income housing point, and you know, none of the high level problems that we're witnessing in the industry or even on the consumer end, none of that's actually going to get addressed until we start building more homes. And you know, the evidence is obviously there that since the Great Recession, that's been the case, that housing starts have sort of fallen off a cliff. And there's been some recovery to it for sure, but it's still nowhere near what it was, say, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And the only way to really encourage that is to, I would actually advocate for, you know, that people at the very local level need to go out and encourage their neighbors to. There's sort of this YIMBY or NIMBY attitude that people have, where, you know, you're either supportive or not supportive of affordable housing in your neighborhoods. And so I think that's sort of a core structural issue, is how do you convince people that more housing is necessary, that it's not going to, you know, destroy the character of their neighborhood, or it's not going to cause their property taxes to shoot way up. I think there's a lot of conversations that really need to happen on a local, a very hyper local level, in order to really start addressing some of this, because, you know, I think there's very obvious examples all over the country of, you know, certain groups wanting to build more affordable housing and then being blocked at every turn by you know, lawyers or just neighbors who don't want to see a certain type of home come into their neighborhood.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a big problem. I don't have any confidence it will get addressed anytime soon, but you know, here's to hoping. I want to finish off with one point. This is a bit of a breaking news story. The GSEs each today released clarifications on their selling guides, and they're essentially saying that the concessions are not going to count toward their cap, right? So the FHA has a cap of, I believe it's 6%. Fannie and Freddie, anywhere between 2 and 9%. And so this is a pretty big deal. It is not a change in policy. The GSEs are just clarifying that they're not going to consider sellers who are paying the buyer's agent that will not go toward that cap of between 2 and 9%. And so this isn't, you know, I think there are a couple ways to look at it. One, any news that the housing agencies or quasi housing agencies have decided to, you know, ensure the public that they're going to be able to roll the financing the buyer agent commission into financing is a positive one for the industry, I think, in terms of, you know, making sure that there are still going to be sales and that this is a little bit easier. But there is still the specter of the DOJ getting involved in the Sitzer-Burnett settlement case and the judge in the case, Stephen Bowe, saying, you know, let's redo the settlement agreement because the DOJ doesn't feel like the consumer is properly, you know, been made whole here, right? And so we don't fully know that these policy clarifications are going to matter much if the DOJ really does make a big stink and call for vast reforms. But I think it's a positive sign that the agencies that are ostensibly in charge of housing finance in this country have decided that they're going to, with no uncertain term, allow buyers to use seller concessions to pay for agents. So positive stuff there. And I think we're going to wrap it up there. Neil, thank you so much for joining. I really do appreciate it. And everybody should check out all the stories we've got. We're going to drop a couple links in there about some of these pieces that we've talked about in today's program. And we'll see you on the next one. Take care, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Housing Wire Daily. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to take a minute to rate the show and leave a comment. And make sure to tune in tomorrow for more news and insight.